My name's Ron Treadgold, and I've been retired from the ERDE, as it was then, since about 1984. Shortly after leaving school, I entered the civil service in early 39 as a lab assistant in the Customs and Excise Department, or actually called Government Chemist Department in the Strand, where the job was to check, it was a place that's actually called the Tin Hut. It was right adjacent to the law courts, a temporary sort of corrugated iron building, where the job was to check the strength of beers for purpose of excise duty. This was based on the original gravity, or sugar content really, of the beers before fermentation. And the job was to distill them, determine the amount of alcohol, convert that into equivalent of sugar, and determine what they called the original gravity. That went on for some months at Strand, when we later moved to the Covent Garden area, and that was quite interesting, because at the time Covent Garden was then the fruit and vegetable market for London, and although we got there about, I suppose, about 9 o'clock, most of the business was over, but there was still quite a life and business going on in the area. Buskers, I walked down from, used to get a tram to Kingsway and walked down along Kingsway to Tavistock Street. Well, that was the, that carried on for about an several months, but then with the outbreak of war, the import and export was much reduced, and so there wasn't the need for the laboratory quite the same way. And I suffered my first redundancy. I was told to go to Waltham Abbey for interview, where I met a certain Walter Blanchard. And was interviewed by him in the little office upstairs in the main lab, and I was accepted as a lab assistant. I travelled from Walthamstow, where I was living at the time, by bike, a distance of about 10 miles, along roads which were absolutely devoid of any traffic whatsoever. And several of us used to meet up and cycle along over the Chingford Mount. Phil Lodge was one of the people I used to see, and a certain Kenny Powis, and a Graham Tant. Three or four of us used to cycle along over the Mount, along the Sewerston Road, we could just, you know, ride anywhere you like. It was four abreast, we'd ride along the Sewerston Road, absolutely deserted. You were soon given warning that you were getting near to the powder mills, because as you approached Quinton Hill, you'd see all the buildings and that, of course, but then when you got over the top of Quinton Hill and started going down towards the old cemetery, if the wind was blowing as it usually did in a westerly, southwesterly direction, it carried all the fumes from the acid factory across the road, and it really was strong. It would sting your face, and in fact the chromium plate on the handlebars used to get quite pitted. A little side issue of this is that the people living in Waltham Abbey, or near this part of the town, got extra clothing allowance coupons, because their curtains, which had to be bought on clothing coupons, used to fall to pieces. And unless you open the windows to get the so-called fresh air, the curtains just rotted away with the acid fumes blown across from the works. Anyway, I wasn't to be given the pleasure of working there for a little while. Well, a little while, I say, about going to be about another 20 years. And then, so right, as we started work at the in the measurement room. That was my first job. You'd enter the gate, check for warned about any cigarettes, clock in at the station alongside the police lodge, clocking in station, and then make your way up to main lab, which at that time was the only one track was over the Flagstaff Bridge, past what became the old library. It wasn't a library then, it was offices, our stores offices and things like that. For the then we'd go through to another searcher's hut, where we were physically tapped and frisked for any matches, etc. Over the little bridge, it's still there, up to the roundabout area, and then we would make our way up towards the main lab. Incidentally, you weren't allowed to go straight up the main walk. Oh, by the way, if there's any cracks, there's a hell of a thunderstorm going on, so if you hear any bangs, that's what it is. There we go. As a lowly staff, we weren't allowed to walk straight along a long walk. Only anybody above the rank of chemist, foreman, and that could walk along there. So we had to take a looping route across what is now Queensmead, and then join up with the long walk near the main lab. In the measurement room, the duties were to receive a number of samples of cordite. Could vary from perhaps as low as 10 to about 40 or 50 in a day. These are wrapped in waxed brown paper. You undid them, and then you had to measure the length of the cordite, if it was in sticks, and the diameter, and any if it was hollow, if it had a hole down the centre, the diameter of the hole by means of a tapered pin, etc. was you measured the diameter, and so and then you had to get the weight per unit length. That was all we had to do with the cordite, but as you had to take a number of samples, 10 or so out of each packet, each one had to be measured. You had quite a full day's work if there was a substantial set, a lot of samples came up. At this stage, you very soon discovered one of the side effects of the job was to suffer from NG heads. Some people used to get it more than others. I was probably lucky, I didn't get it too badly. But you got used to that after a few weeks, and it would disappear, and you'd be wouldn't get it anymore. Of course, we weren't exposed to it like the chaps on the plant who were like in the paste stores, the paste, making up the cordite paste by pouring the nitroglycerine onto gun cotton, and it was then rubbed through sieves by hand. Unfortunately, I never saw any of these processes going on, because being wartime, we weren't allowed to wander far away from the main lab, and certainly couldn't sort of just go out onto the plant. I did, I was fortunate enough to, on one or two occasions, to be invited by one of the shift chemists, working plant chemists, to go down the, and I can't remember the names now, but they took me around to see some of the things going on. I was taken into the MG nitrating hill, saw that, but the most startling thing was to go past the acid factory at Top End. It was you can only describe it as a devil's kitchen. There was just fumes and furnaces and going on all over the place there, and what caught my eye was here and there you would see old cast iron domestic baths full of water, with a crack of steam going into them in the cooler, in the winter and that weather, just to probably just to stop them freezing. It was supposed to just to make it comfortable to jump in. Should anybody working there suffer from a spillage of acid and get acid on them, the first thing I did was take a dive into one of these baths, which you hoped was at a comfortable temperature, not either frozen or scalding. Amongst other jobs that I had in the measurement room was to, at the beck and call of the people in the main lab, we were next to us of course, we had to take a 2-gallon can and go down to the solvent store at the end of the long walk. It's still there today. It was a store used for acetone and mineral jelly. And they would, we would go get the acetone cans filled up and take them up to main lab for use in washing up. Well, amongst talking of washing up, one of the other, we're occasionally allowed to, if we were quiet, if things were not much going on in the measurement room, we could go upstairs and help to wash up the apparatus, which seemed at the time quite a luxury to be able to mix up with the sort of, you know, the real chemists who were doing proper analysis, unlike our miserable little measuring jobs. But anyway, this went on like this, and then after about a, I can't remember, nearly a year, I suppose, I was transferred into the main lab. But on sort of a rota basis, so you had various jobs. There was acid determination from the acid samples from the acid factory, and doing cordite analysis, well, moisture determinations really, and then also we'd see Mr. Blanchard at work. Mr. Blanchard, chemist in charge, would nitrate every new sample of glycerine that came in, and when doing this, a barrier was put around so nobody could approach him while he was standing at the sink doing the nitration of this glycerine. A very important job, of course, that was. Then one of the worst jobs, which nobody wanted to do, but you all had to take your turn, was about 6 months in the tetryl or CE room. That was a really nasty job. We did moistures, sieve analysis, it was particularly unpleasant because of the being so close to this stuff and handling it and sieving it, catching the dust. You turned a quite a bright yellow, not quite as yellow as the chaps on the plant, but quite yellow enough to make you people ask. You know, when you went out on any social event at home, and of course, Mum used to sort of look at me and say, "Are you sure it's all right? You know, do look a funny colour. Do you feel all right?" All this sort of stuff. A story relating to this was that the chaps who worked on the CE plant picked up so much that we were told that the bed clothing and that linen and that would turn bright yellow, and not only that, but their wives tended to pick up some of the yellow colour in the from their husbands. As you can imagine, after our 6 months turn in the CE room was up, we were only too glad to get back and do any job anywhere in the lab, no matter what it was. It was anything was better than that, being in that place. I was incidentally, the chap in charge there at the time when I was in there was Phil Freeman. He was mainly engaged in doing stability tests on tetryl. Lunchtime was an hour, midday, sometime midday, and we used to bring sandwiches, and I don't remember going into the canteen, but we'd go and eat our sandwiches in the library building that is now converted into flats in near the, it's the next building down from the police lodge at the main gate in Powder Mill Lane. That was a useful place to pick up a bit of general knowledge. The place was full of Illustrated London News bound volumes. Must have dated from the end of the 19th century, and we could get these books out. No, you know, there was no librarian. We just would help ourselves and look through these things, and passed many a pleasant hour there. Also, there was available was table tennis, two table tennis. I'm sure no, one table tennis table, I think it was, and upstairs there were two snooker tables. So we used to make use of those. The library was looked after by retired N.G. Hillman. His name was known as Mr. Dennis. I don't know what his other name was, but anyway, he looked after the place. And he always used to lay the fires in the grates. The one downstairs was usually alight, but he was very loath to light the fire upstairs in the snooker room. However cold it was, it was sometimes quite chilly. One chap, George Sewell, took it into his head one day to, while he was playing snooker, to actually light the fire with his with matches, not waiting for Mr. Dennis to come and light it. And there was quite a bit of trouble when old Dennis comes up the stairs and finds the fire already lit. And we were, in fact, ordered out of the building, and don't let it ever happen again, etc., etc. But he soon got over it. Other little episodes for a celebration would be when people were either transferred to another establishment, Bridgewater or Bishopton, perhaps, or some volunteer for the forces. Eric Speller was for the Air Force, I remember. Others were called up for the Pitts, Phil Lodge, and Cyril Povey come to mind there. We would pop along to the Britannia at Waltham Cross, and we'd have our little evening celebration to give them a send-off. One episode I recall from there was when Eric Speller was cycling back one night. He lived in Abbey Road, cycling back from the Britannia. The chain came off the tandem he was driving, riding. Of course, it was a lot of chains and things dangling about, but in the blackout he had to try and get these back on again, which he did as best he could, and he got home and put the bike down the side. And again, at the bottom of the stairs, there was a Joyce shouts out, "Is that you, Eric?" And that, yes, all the rest of it, yes. So up he goes, and still in the blackout, of course, you couldn't put any lights on. Jumped into bed, and that's the end of that. Anyway, the next morning, he was awakened by a horrified wife who was looking at herself and saying, "Look at me, look at the state I'm in." And the poor old Joyce was covered from head to foot, or somewhere else, and I don't know where, in filthy black chain grease. And of course, what had happened was that old Eric didn't realise, I suppose, that his hands were quite as filthy as they were, and had hopped into bed, and given a few loving cuddles to wifey. And that's the result. We didn't let him forget about that for quite some time. For about 6 months, we used to take turns at going into the gun cotton lab, which was in the charge of Percy Smith. And this was a really enjoyable time, it turned out. The jobs there were largely checking up on acid, gun cotton moistures, because gun cotton was made on the south side then. This was, I forgot to mention, was on the south side. And of course we got a much better view of the actual factory working. I didn't go in, ever go in and see the nitration process in the big room, but I had to go and get samples from the acid factory, so we saw that to have a close up. And there was used to sample, there was a thing called a coke box, coke boxes, which was designed to absorb as much as possible of the fumes coming out of the sulfuric acid concentrators. But they didn't do this particularly efficiently, but you take samples from these things, and the exhaust gases were measured, but they were designed by what were their names? Evans Bowden, which I think were two one-time superintendents of the factory. But we could get in there and see the sulfuric acid concentrators, and of course we all know about there were some one or two very nasty accidents there, which a bit too horrific to go into. But I think they're dealt with by one of our other contributors to this series of history tapes. So after about 6 months there, with working with old Percy, he was a great guy, was old Percy Smith. You know, he was very helpful, and was only too pleased to let you do a bit of practical work in connection with this. If you had any interest in chemistry, he would always encourage you. Of course, we weren't doing any evening classes then, though. That was all closed down. But, we'd do acid analysis of strengths of fume in nitric acid. You just get that in. And fume in sulfuric acid, Nordhausen oil of vitriol, I think it's called. And Percy Smith would, he was a very proficient glass blower, and he would blow little ampoules, which we would fill with fuming sulfuric acid and seal off, and then weigh them, crunch them underwater, and then do a titration on them to determine the acid concentration. Anyway, that was very enjoyable. I will look back on that period with much pleasure. And after I finished there, 6 months was up, I went back to main lab. About this time, the early 42, I suppose, the Home Guard unit was formed under the 56 Essex Battalion, which covered that area. All of us were involved, of course. It was a government ruling that we had to do this Home Defence Service, as they called it, and we paraded about three evenings a week, I think, in the grounds, a bit of spare ground behind the old Nitre refinery at Refinery Bridge. There was also a hall there where we were given demonstrations and lectures, especially during inclement weather. Just alongside, there was a large house that was adopted as a battalion headquarters. Can't remember it was a number in High Bridge Street. Can't remember the number of the place, but it was right alongside the almost alongside the river. And I don't think we can't remember us having many rifles. There were a few arrived, and then the Sten guns. Practically everybody except myself and a Norman Kemba finished up with at least one stripe. Some of the more enthusiastic or efficient members of the group, Eric Speller, Povey, Ted Hitch, they managed to get to the rank of captain or major, I think some, and but everybody else was at least a corporal or a sergeant. I was into the signals group, and we assembled in the old library building in Powder Mill Lane, and we were under the auspices of a chap who, Bill Petch, who was a builder, specialised in furnaces, in the Essie factory. Bill Pitch, there was Stuart Reeves from the electrical section, a chap named Brogdon, I think he was electrical. Anyway, there was we used to meet there and practice Morse code on a little oscillator, and flag wagging across the fields, and we laid a few wires across the marshes along where the bypass road now goes. Yeah, they were good times. Occasionally we had to do an all-night duty when there was an exercise. The telephone exchange for the Home Guard was set up in this in the library building, one of the rooms. We must have looked a motley crew, some whose battleship blouses were too large for them. Could be seen wearing blue shirts, and blue shirt and khaki didn't seem to go very well together. You'd get told off for that. Of course, it was a great day when you managed to get through the semaphore and Morse tests, and you could then put up your flags, which were diligently stitched onto our sleeves. Felt very proud of that. Of course, as you might imagine, Home Guard talk used to continue into the main lab, and lots of plans were for laid there in the lab. A little social aspect that we organised during those dark days was the dancing club. Victor Sylvester on the radio was, can you imagine dancing lessons on the radio? We're going strong then, and the idea of meeting some of the girls in the office seemed quite attractive, so we got together and organised ourselves into this dancing club, which met in the drill hall of the army, which was in High Bridge Street. But it was after at the latter end of the war, it was destroyed by a V2 rocket that landed in the middle of the street. I think there's still some photographs about of that area at the time. Yes, we met there. I think it was Wednesday night. We meet at the have a cup of tea or something, and go straight on down to the no dinner. Just go straight down to the hall. There was a little sort of canteen gas stove there, have something to eat, and some armchairs, you could take it a bit easy. It's a nice little place actually. And I was given the job of making an amplifier. I was getting quite keen on amplifiers and radios and things at the time. And I made this amplifier, and the Building Works Department made me a couple of large speaker baffles, which we hung up in the roof, and that was our source of musical background. The lessons were given by a member of the Woolwich group. I haven't mentioned the Woolwich group till now. Ben Davis, with his friend, partner, whatever you are, Eileen, and they were two all brilliant dancers, and they taught most of us the basic steps, and it was I was very pleased with that, because it meant you could have a little night out without going through the blackout once a week. We collected all the strict tempo Sylvester records, and sometimes we would come straight off a parade from the Home Guard, and we'd only be in our uniforms and wearing army boots, which the girls didn't take to particularly. I was June Natman, the daughter of the superintendent at the time. She used to come along, and of course most of us are a bit sort of nervous of asking for a dance, but we would draw lots to decide who was going to be the lucky one to go and ask June for a dance. That caused a bit of fun. A number of marriages took place as a result of that, not least Cyril Povey's, and he married June Buller, and myself, who married Edna Scarborough, both from the office in Powder Mill Lane. Can't for the moment think of any more, but well, that all, you know, it all carried on much the same until redundancy loomed in early 43, when it was decided that the as a production unit, the factory would be phased out and work would be sent to other more remote stations, since it was very close to a built-up area and also was quite handy for in the bombing range. So I was having been one of the later ones to come in. I was given my redundancy and suggested that I should go to de Havilland's to see if I could get a job there, which because they were on to jet propulsion, the jet engines, and they thought that, you know, the familiarity with explosives etc. would have would they find me useful, which they did. I went there for an interview and was taken on, and so thus ended my period in the gunpowder factory. So I don't know if there's any other points to make. I mentioned the Woolwich staff. They came from Woolwich, was not evacuated but spread around a bit, and we had a group from Woolwich. There was Harold Grant, Scammerton, Kemp, names fail me for the moment. Anyway, they worked in with us, but they always had a rather them and us sort of attitude to it, and we were sort of factory staff and they were the sort of chemical inspectorate area. In fact, one of the things some of them used to practice was a form of backslang. I'm sure it was only so that we wouldn't understand what they were saying. It was a very complicated method in which you sort of spelt out the sentence letter by letter. But we practiced it and we got quite good at it. So, you know, I'll finish on two or three little diversions. It was all the rage then to, of course, have Brill Cream on one's hair, and one couldn't get Brill Cream, and so a little sort of sideline in the lab was emulsifying liquid paraffin with lime water in a Horlicks mixer. That produced this sort of oily white mixture that was accepted as Brill Cream. We had earth toilets, which probably already know, seen them, but they were one we used wasn't far away from the lab, and I remember one day Ted Hitch popped out there, and he got caught by one of the old tricks of opening the flap at the back and stuffing a handful of thistles up inside the seat of the unfortunate victim. You can imagine what that caused. And of course it was a crafty trick, because having trousers down, couldn't run very fast. And Ted got caught one day, and he came back to the lab. He was quite irate about it all. And there's another one. The one day, the gas men were working on the mending the joint outside, and been told all round to go and turn off all the Bunsen burners. Well, all had been turned off, as far as we knew, but there must have been one left alight, because they dug this hole and opened up the end of the gas pipe. Then, of course, as the gas floated up, light and air, into the building, there came a point when an explosive mixture had been generated in all gas pipes. And there was a great shrieking noise, went right through the building, frightened the life out of us, and it was the gas exploding in all the pipes. And, of course, there was quite decades of muck and dross and slag and that in the bottom of the pipes. And these poor devils who were digging the hole out in outside were covered in this filthy, evil smelling sludge that was blown out by this mine explosion. There was no serious injury. Nobody, there was only a discomfort of being covered in all this muck. Nobody's actually hurt, fortunately. But that was rather amusing incident for us, anyway, not for them. And last of all, I refer to the bypass on the Long Walk. You remember at the beginning I did mention that there was a big loop road, went right round, leaving the Long Walk, going along through the centre of Queensmead and rejoining near what is now the roundabout. And only senior staff could go along there. So if you were walking along there, you one or two occasions I might have left the lab with one of the chemists or foreman, Ted or George, and we would, at the junction, we would have to part company. We would walk along the loop road and rejoin our friend at the other end of the down by the roundabout, which seemed a funny old custom, but it was, nobody seemed to mind at the time, and they didn't laugh. Well, that was just the rule, that lower orders couldn't walk along. The reason they did it was because they were still working the gunpowder mills. There's a line of gunpowder mills on the western side of the Long Walk, and these are still active, and only chemists and foremen etc. could approach within so many yards of them. Well, I think we'll leave Waltham Abbey now, and then I spent about 10 years at de Havilland's. Work there was mainly metallurgical analysis, chicken plating bars, and oils, fuels, and everything, anything to do with enamel finishes, and anything to do with aircraft. It was a very interesting time because I had the opportunity of seeing the jet engines in their early development stage. Very modern machinery had been installed on, been sent over on the lease land, and it was we could, you know, wander around the shops. There wasn't the same sort of attitude then for leaving the lab as there was at the powder works, and wander around and see this new machinery working, which was quite exciting at the time. I did get my first aircraft ride there. I went up. I spent time at Hatfield. And you could get, if you, they had a flying test bed, two outboard props and two inboard jets. And if you wanted to, you could go up on a flight, which I asked to do one day. And most amazing experience. I left the airfield just after lunch. Well, up we went. It wasn't very comfortable. There was no seats. We just squatted on the floor and all stood up, looked out the windows. And as part of the test, of course, they went up and down, perhaps up to 10,000 feet and down again to sea level. So the old ears were playing up a bit. And went out over the south coast, down the channel, round Biscay, back over France, came back over the North Sea, could see dozens of wrecks because the sea at that height looked extremely shallow and it's calm. And you could see these wrecks of these ships lying on the bottom of the sea. And came back, touched down, and we got down just in time. They were just finishing tea, and it seemed the most amazing experience that we could leave, go and have a quick look at Spain, France, North Sea, and be back again in time for a cup of tea. But, well, in 1954, I felt that I'd like to get nearer home again. It's getting quite a long ride, about 12 miles or so. And the traffic was not getting any better, even though it was 1954. And so I applied, been told that there were some vacancies at Waltham Abbey, and I applied and I was taken on by as an EO. I was appointed on P2 section, once again with Phil Freeman as my superintendent, and the work there was the testing of propellant ingredients and the finished product, physical properties, purity, moisture, etc., etc. And then I worked there for about, I think I was there for about 3 years, and in about 1958 I was transferred to the south site on the same section on the small scale production. I enjoyed the work very much and took a delight in trying to invent new methods of testing and charge manufacture and things like that. And I was very fortunate in that our section leaders, John Scrivener and John Vernon, encouraged me in this practice. And I always look back on that time with great relish. There was one name I must mention is Bob Page. We had a workshop attached to the place, and he didn't mind me going into his shop, and he taught me no end of things about the technique of engineering and turning, etc., and for which I was ever grateful. Sadly, he died a couple of years ago. And that reminds me of another sad death on the south site, that one morning, Joe Archer, who was the foreman in charge of the small scale production in building P720, didn't arrive. And it transpired that he'd been waiting at the bus in the Newtown Waltham Abbey, and this bus, or perhaps it was another vehicle, anyway, mounted the pavement and at the bus stop and knocked him over, and he was killed. Very sad we all were about that. Well known character was Joe, great, both in the works and locally. Southside was a beautiful area to spend most of one's working life, and as I go past it now, very sad to see it all swept away and now used as a building site. Well, I think that's about all I feel like saying now. I've concentrated on the earlier days because they obviously like to be less recorded than the last 20 or 30 years. There's not many left now that saw the place as it was working in wartime, and so I think we'll leave it at that.